Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for 1 hour from 2 to 3 each weekday afternoon Pacific time, and able to take your calls. If you would like to call with any questions you might have about the Bible or about the Christian faith, or maybe just about your own Christian walk or your own spiritual journey if you're not even a Christian. You know, if you're not a Christian and you have objections to Christianity, I'd love to hear what they are. I'd be glad to talk to you about them. Challenges to the Christian faith or the Bible are always welcome here. So this isn't just a program for Christians. Truly, most of the people who call are Christians trying to understand the Bible better. But we also welcome calls from those who are in no sense regarding themselves to be Christians, but have questions or objections you'd like to raise. Let me give you a phone number so you can reach me here. The lines are open right now. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And I'd like to make an announcement for those of you listening in Las Vegas, because I'll be in Las Vegas this weekend, this Saturday. I'll be speaking on the topic toward a radically Christian counterculture. I've been doing this about once a month, coming to town and working on this series toward a radically Christian counterculture. Now, what's that mean? Well, you'd have to come to find out. Intriguing title, though. And we hope that you'll come out and not only be there for the teaching, but there's also a potluck meal. There's also a time of fellowship and general questions and answers that we actually, I think we start at 4, 3 or 4. I think 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And so the teaching part is later, like from 6 to 7. But there's a time of fellowship, questions and answers, just general informal getting to know each other. And for those of you who listen in Las Vegas but don't know very many other people who think like you do, and you like the program, would like to meet other people who like this program, feel free to join us this Saturday, because you'll find that there are other people like yourself there in your own neighborhood. To find out specifics about the meeting, you'll go to thenarrowpath.com and click on the link that says announcements. Now, we actually hold it at the Toyota dealership in Henderson. There's a conference room upstairs, and we use that room. So if you know where the large Toyota dealer is in Henderson, that's where we'll be. If you don't know, there's a map and instructions at our website, thenarrowpath.com, and there you click on the link that says announcements, and you'll learn everything you need to know about day after tomorrow. I'll be in Las Vegas. Okay, Mike from Las Vegas is our first caller. Welcome to The Narrow Path, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Hey, yeah, thank you. The question is, I have a problem. I've been trying to read the Bible and everything, and I'm just trying to, I talk to a lot of Christians, and you know, and they want me to love God, and I just can't even love myself, let alone love something I can't see or talk, you know, or get in touch with.
Uh-huh.
I really get lost in it. I just can't find stuff. I love something that I can't see or touch or hear from.
Yeah.
What's your suggestion on this?
Well, suppose
I'll listen to you off the air.
Okay, Mike, I appreciate your call. Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we were done. I didn't mean to cut you off. Suppose from your childhood on, there was somebody overseas that you established a pen pal relationship with, and you wrote back and forth. You'd never met the person, never seen them, but they would send you tokens of friendship. You might even ask them for things, and they would send them to you, and you might send things back to them, and you actually have all the features of a real relationship with this person, except you've never laid eyes on them. It, depending on the nature of that relationship, it would not be impossible for you to develop a fondness for that person without ever having seen them. You may not have even seen their picture. You can't even picture what they look like, but maybe probably in your head you have an imaginary picture. But the point is, you're getting to know them based on something other than seeing them. You're getting to know them based on communication from them, and perhaps kind acts that they show toward you, as I said, sending you gifts or whatever. I don't know of any case where people became acquainted this way, though, of course, there is such a thing as pen pals, and there may be such cases that I've never run across. The point is, I can imagine a situation like that easily enough, And I can also imagine how in such a situation you could become, you could even fall in love with somebody. Now, of course, we're in a society where we fall in love. We mean that term very shallowly. And in fact, we may fall in love with people primarily by what they look like rather than anything about them that's intrinsically lovable. But it is possible to love people that you're not attracted to romantically. We don't have to think of love that way. Be more like loving your own children or loving your best friend or loving your parents if you love them. If your dad, for example, from the time you were a baby, was a POW over, you know, seas, had been at war, and you've never met your dad, but he's still alive, he's in prison somewhere, but you've heard all about him. You've seen, you know, your mom has talked about him, people who knew him have talked about him, and you've learned a lot about him. You could actually love your dad, though you've never met him. You know he's alive. You know he's somewhere. You can't get to him. You can't see him. But from what you've learned about him, you could easily admire him and wish to know him. And these are just perhaps not fully adequate analogies. But when it comes to loving God, who you haven't seen, we have seen what he has done. We have seen the world that he created for us to live in. We've seen many kind acts that he's done for us. Now, you might say, well, I don't know that God did those things. I might have just been lucky to be born in America. Might have been just lucky that I'm not a starving child over in Africa, you know, somewhere. I could have been born there as easily. It's true, you could have been. The Bible says every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness or shadow of turning. And the fact is, everything we've enjoyed, which is better than we might have had, is a special blessing that God's given to us. And he hasn't given them to everyone. He gives other people other blessings. But we have all had probably more benefits in life than we've ever, you know, taken stock of. For example, when you get up in the morning and get out of bed and walk across the room, you probably don't think very often how many people there are that haven't taken a step in years and will never take a step again. They're crippled, they're paralyzed. They do anything to be able to walk across the room, but you do it without even thinking. Or when you open up and you see your eyes and see the sunlight in the morning and realize there's people who've never seen light at all. They've been born blind or have gone blind. And, you know, we have all these benefits we take for granted every day. The fact that we have food in our stomachs, we just figure, well, what else? You know, that's what you do. You eat when you're hungry. Yeah, but many people in the world don't have food, and no matter, you know, how long they might long for it, they'll never see a meal like you eat every day. I mean, we have so many benefits. And I think love, the best incentive to love is gratitude. I think that if you recognize that somebody has done kind things for you that you didn't deserve, you didn't do anything to earn them, but they just did them for you, I think that's what love is supposed to be sparked by. The Bible says we love him because he first loved us. And he has loved us by, that is, he's shown his love to us in many ways. Paul, in Acts chapter 14, was talking to a bunch of heathen who had never heard of the real God, and he's trying to introduce them to the real God because they worshipped idols. And he said, you know, this God, you don't know who he is, but he's given you tokens of his kindness. He's given you fruitful seasons and rain and harvests and so forth. And what Paul is saying is that God, although you've never heard of him or known him, has been doing kind things for you all your life. And to love God simply means to stop being ungrateful and to say, you know, I owe God a lot. I appreciate what God has done. He didn't have to be so good to me, and he did. And in gratitude is, I think, one of the most fundamental blocks in building a foundation of love towards somebody. So the fact that you can't see God doesn't have to prevent you from loving him. Obviously, you can say, well, you know, all those nice things that have happened to me, I've done those for myself. I eat well because I work hard. I've got a good job. Or I'm healthy because I take care of myself. Or, you know, just the good things I have, they're just coincidental. Well, you can say all those things if you want to, and if you do, that will probably be very effective in keeping you from being grateful to God, but there's no reason to have to take such a stand. The truth of the matter is everything we have is due to things that we had no control over. Even if you work hard, it's because you have physical strength and ability to work hard. Some people don't, or because you have the mental ability to do so. You know, some people take very good care of themselves and die young. there's really everything about your life is out of your control. There is a cause and effect relationship between some things you do and some of the results. But many of those things are themselves resting on circumstances over which you have no control at all. And you can either say it's coincidence, or you can recognize that it's the goodness of God. If you're not convinced that there is a God, of course, then coincidence is going to be the only option for you. If you have thought about it intelligently enough to know that there, of course, must be a God, then you can look at it a little differently. And once you've recognized that there is a God, and you begin to take stock of all the advantages he's given you, which you've never even thanked him for, and which you did nothing to deserve, that's the beginning of learning to love God. Now, eventually, if you think enough about it or learn enough about it, you'll realize that not only has he done the things that you could currently make a list of for you, but he's done something far more, and that is that he sent his son to earth to die for you so that you could be restored into a relationship with him. That, too, I would think more than most things, would be grounds for loving him and for being grateful to him. So those are just some thoughts. Obviously, more could be said, but we've got our lines full and I need to move along. I hope that is helpful to you, though, Mike. Let's talk to Sandy from Marysville, Washington. Sandy, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, Steve. I really enjoy your teaching. I'm calling today to see if you can recommend some books, articles, literature on two topics. I am a Christian mom, and I have three children under the age of 11. And this past weekend, two of my older children were exposed to some extreme Muslim teaching, and so I need to help them understand some of the things that they were told, but I'm not fully informed of what Muslims believe. I can only share what they were told. One of the things they were told was Jesus doesn't exist, even though they said they believed in the Bible, the Quran, and the Torah, but they said that Jesus didn't exist. They were told that Easter is based on a pagan holiday, and that the New Testament was written by man and that is not the inspired word of God. So how can I help them to understand that I'm under the assumption that the Muslim religion is a cult, and I want to teach them the truth so that if they have these interactions again, they'll be prepared.
Okay, well, if they were talking to real Muslims, there's no Muslim that would say Jesus never existed, because in the Quran, Jesus is considered to be the greatest of the prophets, even greater than Muhammad.
Okay.
But not the Son of God. The Muslims deny many things that the Bible affirms. They deny that Jesus died. And, of course, they deny that he rose again. They believe that Judas died on the cross instead of Jesus. And that he looked enough like Jesus that people thought it was Jesus who died on the cross. They have some pretty strange views out there. So they would not teach that there was no Jesus. Or if they did teach that, they weren't Muslims. They do believe in Jesus, and they believe he's a great prophet, just not the last of the prophets. I think Muhammad was the last prophet. And therefore, what he says actually preempts what Christians believe. There's a lot of good books out critiquing Islam. I can give you some names of authors or names of books if you'd like. There's one called A Religion of Peace? By Robert Spencer.
Okay.
It's A Religion of Peace? And the subtitle is Why Christianity Is and Islam Isn't. There's one called Jesus and Muhammad: Profound Differences and Surprising Similarities by Mark A. Gabriel, Ph.D. Now, Mark A. Gabriel wrote a number of books, and he's, I think he's a former Muslim himself. He was able to quote the Quran by the time he was 12 years old. He was raised in Egypt, et cetera, et cetera. He's written also a book. He wrote Jesus and Muhammad. He wrote a book called Islam and Terrorism, and I don't remember what other books he's written. He's written a fair bit. There's a book called Reasoning from the Scriptures with Muslims by Ron Rhodes, spelled R-H-O-D-E-S. Ron Rhodes wrote a book, Reasoning from the Scriptures with Muslims. There's a book called A Christian's Response to Islam. I'm holding these books on my lap right now.
Okay.
A Christian's Response to Islam by James L. Garlow. Don Richardson, a man whose books on missiology I've read several of, but I haven't read this book yet, has one called Secrets of the Quran. He was a Christian missionary for many years in Irian Jaya. Don Richardson, Secrets of the Quran. And then two brothers who were former Muslims, but who are both Christians now. I think they're both seminary professors now. Their last name is Kaner, C-A-N-E-R.
Okay.
One of them is named Ergun Kaner, and the other is Emir Kaner.
Okay.
But they wrote a book called Unveiling Islam. And so a lot of these books I just mentioned are written by people who were formerly Muslims,
okay,
but have become Christians. And some of them are just written by Christian missionary types who've studied it. So those are some of the books available. I have to say I haven't read all of them. I bought them and I've read from them. And I've read some of them, but I haven't read all the books I just named. So I can't tell you which are the best ones.
Okay. This is very helpful. I mean, I didn't start with a list. You've given me more than what I was expecting. So this is wonderful. The other discussion that we are talking about with an 11-year-old is gay and lesbian, because they've been exposed to that in school. The way I was brought up, it was primarily focused on the sexual orientation or interest. And so that kind of steered me clear of, you know, okay, I know that's bad. Today it's that part of it is seems like it's being kind of swept under the rug. How do I approach it today with my kids so they can handle those discussions at 11 years old?
Well, they shouldn't be exposed to these discussions at 11 years old. Unfortunately, the public schools are trying to get it in as early as first grade and earlier.
Correct.
To the kids. You know, it's interesting. Before there was a gay agenda, no heterosexuals ever tried to get to the kindergartens and teach them sex education or teach them about normative sex. However, deviations from the norm, they want to get to them as young as they can.
Right.
Maybe because they realize that nature itself kind of abhors it, and they want to try to they want to cut nature off at the pass. Before these kids get old enough to have any real sexual thoughts at all, they want to kind of reorient them toward seeing some things as normal that they otherwise would not if left to their natural reactions. But now, are your children Christians?
Yes.
Okay. What I would want to do is not bash homosexuals, but rather build a positive view of what God made marriage for.
Okay.
God made marriage to be a man and a woman for the simple reason that he intended them to reproduce. When God made man and woman, he said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So obviously reproduction was the idea behind creating sexual relations. And so God created a man and woman because it takes a man and a woman to actually reproduce. And now, sexual activity, I don't know how much your children know about this or how much you want to talk about it, but sexual activity outside of marriage is simply wrong. Sex is for marriage. And that doesn't make any difference whether it's gay or straight.
Right.
You know, this is not a gay bashing issue. This is a fornication bashing issue, in the sense that we don't believe that fornication is right, whether it's gay or straight. And to call it homophobic is simply to turn it into a political issue, which it isn't. It's not a political issue. It's a matter of wanting to preserve normalcy in human sexuality. And true,
right,
the church has not been consistent in defending normal sexuality. And therefore, for example, the church has not been strong against divorce.
Right.
When churches allow divorce for no good cause, they are undermining biblical sexuality and biblical marriage. And the church has been undermining that for 50 years. And so when the church then wants to speak up and say, well, we're against same-sex marriage, well, the church has lost all credibility. They haven't defended normal marriage. The church is such a mess, frankly. I mean, when I say the church, I don't mean all churches. Some churches have upheld marriage, but not many. And so, you know, the church is looked at as rather hypocritical. You know, they don't defend godly marriage until they're afraid of the gays getting married, and then they want to stand up for real marriage. I think what we need to do with our kids is teach them about biblical marriage and biblical sexuality, and let them know that sex is for marriage, and marriage is at least not entirely for, but very largely for the sake of reproduction. Now, you know, if you say marriage is entirely for reproduction, people will say, well, what about old couples who are past the childbearing years? Can't they have sex anymore? Or, you know, what about a man who finds out his wife is barren and she can't have kids? Should they have not have sex anymore? Obviously, you know, there are exceptions. But the point is, marriage had as one of its primary functions reproduction. And while there may be other functions as well, we can't just remove that one out and say, you know, marriage is normal without it. It's not. It's true there are barren people, but that's not normal. That's a result of the fall. That's a health problem. That's
right.
That's not how God designed things to be. So, you know, where I'd go would be to Matthew chapter 19,
okay,
verses 1 through 9. And there, of course, homosexuality is not the issue, but marriage is the issue. And Jesus is asked by the Pharisees, is it lawful to divorce your wife for every cause? And Jesus said, no, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. And they said, well, then why did Moses permit giving a writing of divorcement? And Jesus said, well, because of the hardness of your heart, God permitted you to divorce your wives. But he said, but from the beginning, it was not so. In other words, Jesus is saying when we're supposed to be thinking about marriage, we should go back to how it was from the beginning, like before the fall. God made a man and a woman. He put them together and made them one flesh, made a family out of a marriage. And that's how God wanted it. Now, Jesus admits some things have been permitted, like divorce, because things have gone wrong. But the Christian should be wanting things to go right, not wrong. Therefore, if we want to understand marriage, we should, as Jesus said, think about how God did it in the beginning. And so we can see what marriage is supposed to be. It's supposed to be monogamous. It's supposed to be lifelong. It's supposed to have reproduction as one of its features, if possible. And while some of these things, you know, may be affected negatively by the fall, we're not supposed to redefine the norm by things that fall short of the norm. We don't lower the bar just because some marriages knock the bar off the poles. You know, some marriages don't make it over the bar, but we're going to still define marriage by where the bar belongs, I think. And therefore, you do all this without even having to mention homosexuality.
Right.
You don't have to target homosexuals. Just target what's right, what God intended, and then let them know. And there's lots of ways that people try to change what God ordained. Some of them are gay, some of them are straight. But whether you're gay or straight, you don't have the authority to change what God created, and that's marriage.
Okay. I like their approach better than what I had started with. They simply just came home, and they sent home a letter when my oldest son was in first grade saying that they were going to talk about that issue. And so when he brought it home, his question was, what's the difference between a homosexual person and a heterosexual person? I'm thinking, okay. So I didn't start with marriage.
When the school notified you they were going to be talking about it, did they give you an opt-out option? Were you allowed to keep your child home that day or out of that class?
I did end up keeping my child home that day, but the discussion kind of went to the next day, and so he was talking with another child, and they were discussing it. But
one thing I would tell my children. See, we homeschooled our children just to avoid that kind of thing. But if you're not homeschooling and can't homeschool, then one thing you should definitely tell your children is the people at your school, in many cases, are people who don't know God, and do not agree with God. Okay, and our family, we do know God and we do agree with God. So you're going to have to expect to hear your teachers sometimes say and your friends say things that aren't right because they don't know God and they don't agree with God. But we want to agree with God. You know, this is possible. When I was in the second grade, my parents had not yet even taught me anything to beware of evolution. I think they didn't expect me to hear about evolution in the second grade. But we had a film strip in our second grade classroom about how the earth was formed by breaking off of the sun and so forth. And I thought about that, I thought, wait a minute, that's not what the Bible says. And I actually approached my teacher about it. And I says, you know, I think the people who made that film strip were wrong, because the Bible says in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and then later he made the sun. So that film strip said that the sun was there first and the earth came later. They must have been wrong. And my teacher said, oh, they must have forgotten. And that was the end of that. But see, my parents had taught me positively what the Bible says. Then they didn't have to tell me what all the wrong ideas would be that I'd hear. You know, if you know what the right truth is, then it's easier to recognize the wrong ideas. Your parents don't always anticipate everything wrong that they think they're going to hear. But if you teach your children to be valiant for what's true, and you teach them what's true, that'll go a long way toward inoculating them.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give it another try, and I'll probably be calling you back. But thank you so much for your assistance and your teaching. I appreciate it.
Okay, Sandy. Thanks for your call.
Bye.
God bless you. Bye now. Cynthia from Bremerton, Washington is next. Cynthia, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Steve. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for waiting.
I want to say we're also a homeschooling family for the very same reasons that you mentioned.
Uh-huh.
And it's just a lot less stress on us not having to undo what the schools do.
Well, they're coming after you. They're coming after you, though.
Yes, they are. Well, my question was about the armor of God, and particularly about the part where it says, put on the whole armor of God. I was in a discussion with someone, and they pretty much said that that's something that we're to do every day, going through the whole process of putting on each piece of armor.
Right. They want you to sit at your bedside and pantomime putting on a helmet and a breastplate and all that stuff, right?
Exactly. And that didn't make sense to me because it also says to put on the new man. And so I'm thinking,
pretend like you're putting on a wetsuit or something and zip it up. Yeah, and you just put on the new man. It's the Jesus skin.
Yeah, and I thought that doesn't make sense. I thought it just meant we're to use what we know God has given us. It's not this process of saying that and getting outside and thinking, oh, I forgot to do that, and then freaking out because you feel like you're out there without your armor.
Well, you've got way too much common sense.
So I thought I'm going to call Steve and ask him about this.
Yeah, well, I'm on your side. I've actually heard it taught a lot. I mean, I don't know where this started or if people just make this mistake by themselves or independently. Mm-hmm. But it's very commonplace when people read about the helmet of salvation, the breastplate of righteousness, the belt of truth, and the shield of faith. They say, okay, now Paul says to put these things on, so, you know, go through the motions. Use your hands like you're putting a helmet on your head and say, I'm putting on the helmet of salvation. Now strap on the breastplate of righteousness and blah, blah, blah. This is not what Paul meant. I really don't believe that Paul sat up on his cot in prison every day and went through these motions. Look at what the armor is. The helmet is what? It's salvation.
That's
the breastplate is what? It's righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
The belt is what? It's truth.
Mm-hmm.
The shield is what? It's faith. In other words, these are just the normal things of Christian life. I mean, the Bible talks about righteousness. It talks about salvation. It talks about faith. It talks about truth through the whole Bible. It just doesn't always use the analogy of armor to talk about it. But see, Paul in that place is using the analogy of armor. He's talking about ordinary Christian things. I mean, if you know what faith is, if you know what righteousness is, if you know what salvation is, if you know what the truth is, then you've already got the armor. What Paul is doing is saying, you know, life is a battle. You know, you're in a wrestling match against principalities and powers and so forth. And these things that God has given you serve you in the battle the way that armor serves a soldier. These things will protect you from the various ways in which the devil will attack you. He's not saying pantomime getting suited up in the in the locker room. He's saying realize that your salvation is indeed a helmet against the enemy's attacks. Your righteousness guards your heart like a breastplate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the truth and faith and those other things that are in there are all factors in every Christian's life, and he's just encouraging us to see them in the light of the whole issue of spiritual battle. Those things serve us in the battle.
Okay.
So I think you understood that almost intuitively better than the person who was talking to you.
Okay, thank you. One other quick question. Are there apostles today?
If they are, they're sure hiding well.
Because I saw a program on TV where this man, it was some ceremony, and he's now called an apostle. And
well, I'm not surprised. There's a lot of people who call themselves apostles. There's certain movements. There's certain movements that call their founders apostles. There are self-proclaimed apostles. You know, the Bible indicates that as well as true apostles, there are false apostles.
Okay.
And in Revelation chapter 2, when Jesus is addressing the church of Ephesus there, he says, I know your works, that you have tested those who say they are apostles and are not, and you found them liars. And this is one of the commendations Jesus gives them. He's commending them for that, that they didn't just accept somebody's claim to be an apostle. They tested it. And if they were a false apostle, they found them to be liars. That's what we have to do sometimes. Now, are there real apostles? There may be, but I'll just express my doubts about this for the simple reason. For the past 43 years I've been in the ministry, I've been in circles, what we call charismatic circles.
Right.
Now, charismatic people are more likely than non-charismatic people to be looking at things like prophets and apostles and things like that. I mean, they emphasize more the gifts of the Spirit than others do.
Okay.
And I have been in those circles, not only in this country, but on every continent. I teach around the world, and I've been on every continent in charismatic circles. I've certainly seen my share of people who were said to be apostles, but when I tested them, they weren't. So I'm thinking, if God has some real apostles out there, he sure keeps them well hidden. And it doesn't seem like he would. You know, it seems like if there's a real apostle, it should be easy enough to spot him.
Okay.
But in 43 years, I haven't really met him.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Stephen. I certainly appreciate all that you shared, and I love your program.
All right. Well, God bless you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. You know, whenever I say that I've never met an apostle, sometimes a friend of mine will point out to me that he and I both know a man who might possibly qualify as an apostle, a man from India that we met, who has, you know, he plants churches and he does signs and wonders and so forth. Though I don't remember if the man himself calls himself an apostle. There are people who do things similar to apostles. I often think of Sundar Singh, the Indian Christian, back at the turn of the 20th century. He acted an awful lot like an apostle and had signs and wonders and all the. In fact, Jesus even appeared to him at his conversion, just like Paul's conversion. And yet, I don't think Sundar Singh ever claimed to be an apostle. So if a man doesn't claim to be an apostle, we don't have to test the claim because it doesn't exist. But in his case, if Sundar Singh said he was an apostle, I might even believe it. But, you know, he died over about 100 years ago. And I've met one man from India who might conceivably have such a ministry, but I don't even know that he claims to be an apostle. So, you know, once in a while you meet people who might, if they claim they're apostles, you might even believe it. But I just don't find the two things in the same person. A, he claims to be an apostle. B, he has evidence of being an apostle. So, again, they're mighty hard to find if they're out there. Let's talk to Kevin from Amity, Oregon, my old former neighbor in Amity. Hi, Kevin.
How you doing, Steve?
Good.
Hey, got a couple questions. They're somewhat related, and I'm trying to figure out. Like, the first question is, which of the early church fathers hold your position? And then the other question that sort of ties into it is, what do you think makes a dispensationalist? Now, the reason why the early church fathers, I've been revisiting my church history, and it seems like there's more of the early church fathers who seem to hold to my position. There are futurists, premillennial, such as Polycarp, Ignatius, Papias, some of their disciples, such as Irenaeus, Hippolytus.
All premillennial, but none of them dispensationalists.
Well, there you go.
They are what's usually called historic premillennial, right?
Well, they believe in a future of Antichrist. They believe in a future 1,000 years.
Right.
They believe in a tribulation time.
Of some sort. Not necessarily a 7-year tribulation. Right. That Jesus mentioned,
they believe in, they mentioned 3.5 years.
Yeah, it'd be more common.
Tribulation.
It'd be more common for them to say 3.5 years. I think a
7-year
tribulation.
I mean, they sound like a dispensationalist to me.
Well, those are not the traits that are distinctive of dispensationalism. Those are the traits distinctive of premillennialism.
Okay, what are traits of what do you consider? Because for your audience, I'm a dispensationalist. So,
right. Dispensationalists believe, and the early church fathers did not believe. Dispensationalists believe that there are still unfulfilled promises that God's made to Israel, and that Israel remains, in some sense, God's chosen people, in spite of the fact that the church has now arisen as God's chosen people. Dispensationalists believe there's two chosen peoples, and that probably what distinguishes dispensationalists more than any other thing is their view about Israel, because the early fathers didn't believe that. This is Darby's view. Now, also, dispensationalists, as you know, because, I mean, you're a very well-studied and very knowledgeable dispensationalist, I know from our previous talks, dispensationalists are committed to what's usually called a literal hermeneutic of prophecy. And because of that, they tend to see a number of prophecies as unfulfilled because they have not been literally fulfilled, although the early Christian fathers believed they had been fulfilled spiritually and did not require a literal fulfillment. So, the historic premillennialists, they shared your view that there will be a millennium, but they did not believe, as dispensationalists do, that there would be a Jewish temple in the millennium or Levitical priests offering animal sacrifices in the millennium. That is, the historic premillennialists did not believe that the millennium had a Jewish character to it or a Jewish religious character. They did believe in a future Antichrist, but they believed he would rise as soon as the Roman Empire fell. Now, these guys lived, of course, in the first 4 centuries of the church, so they didn't live to see the Roman Empire fall. But they all said that the Antichrist will rise when the Roman Empire falls. And that's the reason, actually, that the Reformers identified the papacy with the Antichrist. The Reformers all thought
the
papacy.
Okay, but when you say early church fathers, they didn't believe in a literal interpretation of Scripture.
Prophecy, right. They believed that many prophecies about Israel and Jerusalem were actually fulfilled in the church. They were what we call replacement theologians.
Who takes a spiritual allegorical approach? Clement of Alexandria, Origen.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't say allegorical approach. Kevin, here's a problem that is universal among dispensationalists. When you say non-literal, they want to say allegorical. I don't take an allegorical approach to any passage of Scripture, but I take a spiritual approach to many of the ones. See, people want to bring up Clement and Origen as examples of allegorical approach, and they are. They were allegorical. But most church fathers were not allegorical, and there's not a living amillennialist today who takes an allegorical approach that I know of. The allegorical approach, here's what the allegorical approach looks like. They say, Abraham, in the stories of Abraham and Isaac and Sarah, so Abraham represents wisdom, and Sarah represents, feminine wisdom or something like that. And they'll talk about, they'll take these kind of ethereal concepts and try to apply stories of the Old Testament to these ethereal concepts. That's called the allegorical approach. It was followed by Philo, the Jew, before there were Christians. And then later in the 3rd century, people like Clement of Alexandria and Origen picked up on it, and everything they said was entirely far-fetched. Now, if you go back to previous to Origen, in the 2nd century, Justin Martyr, like you mentioned, Justin Martyr and Irenaeus and Tertullian and Hippolytus, all these guys were premillennial, but they all spiritualized. They didn't allegorize, but they spiritualized the passage. That means they saw many passages that predicted things about Israel or Jerusalem as being fulfilled in a spiritual Israel or a spiritual Jerusalem, which they took to be the church. Now, that's not allegorizing. Dispensationalists throw the word allegorizing around very flippantly without having a clue what it looks like. You see, all amillennialists spiritualize, but none of them allegorize. Allegorization was a specific kind of crazy interpretation that was
popular.
I'm not
saying there wasn't any allegorizing. Apostle Paul allegorizes in
Isaac and Ishmael in Galatians 4, yeah. Mm-hmm.
No. The word that he uses for spiritualizer, a symbol, is the word where we get allegory.
I know. That's in Galatians 4, right. He says that Ishmael and Isaac were an allegory, right.
Well, he says that Hagar, the bond woman and the free woman, were allegories too.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. That's the same passage. Right, that's the same passage. Yeah.
So, in that sense, I'm not saying that they're, but those are stated allegories. But to the idea of spiritualizing, well, in other words, what you just said was that some of these early church fathers did a literal interpretation on the millennium, on a future judgment. 3.5
right.
years they applied to that judgment. They
right.
did a future antichrist. Those are all dispensational key tenets of a dispensationalist.
Well, wait. The deity of Christ.
Wait. Pre-millennial.
Kevin, the deity of Christ and the virgin birth are key elements of dispensationalism too, but they're not the distinctives of dispensationalism. See, Roman
right,
Catholics...
These are the distinctives of dispensationalism.
No, they're not. They are not. They are distinctives of premillennialism. See, premillennialism exists in two types. There's dispensational premillennialism and historic premillennialism. And basically anyone who's studied theology can point that out to you and can point out the differences. Premillennialism is just the broad category of those who believe there will be a millennium after Jesus comes back. Among those who hold that, there have been lots of different kinds of theologies. I mean, the Jehovah's Witness, you used to be a Jehovah's Witness. You know that they're premillennial. Now, are they dispensational?
Right.
Are Jehovah's
yeah.
Witnesses dispensational? No, they're not. They believe that Israel in Revelation
are Israel.
Right, they believe they are. And so they are not dispensationalists because dispensationalists say you should not confuse Israel with the church. It's two different entities. But the Jehovah's Witnesses, who are premillennial, are not dispensational, right?
See, I think what has happened here is we go through and someone like yourself comes along and you say, well, dispensationalist starts with John Nelson Darby. So anything he promotes as dispensational, some of the church fathers did believe in a future for Israel. And
no, I don't
so
think
therefore
so.
They
which
were
ones?
They were dispensational.
Wait, which ones did?
So therefore, in that sense,
Kevin, I ask you a question.
No one
I ask you a question. Can you hear me?
Theology.
Can you hear me, Kevin? Okay.
Yeah,
which,
I can hear you.
You said some of the church fathers believed in a future for Israel. I'd like to know which ones.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll get together a list, and I'll call back another day, and I'll get you those so that you can see, because I've been going through so many of them, and they've made certain statements and so forth that if I told you one, I might be off on which one said exactly what.
Fair enough.
Here's the key is that... the only distinction that you're saying that is dispensational, in other words, a lot of the early church fathers believe as I do. They believe in a premillennial. They believe in a judgment, a great tribulation that will proceed. They believe in a resurrection before the 1,000 years. They believe...
That's premillennialism.
If you ask dispensationalists what you believe... They believe those things, and it's based upon their dispensational approach to the Scriptures.
See, here you're wrong. I mean, the dispensationalists, they do believe those things based on their dispensational approach. But see, they believe in the millennium as the fulfillment of the promises that God made to Israel. That's what you believe. You believe the millennium is going to be the fulfillment of many Old Testament passages about how God would redeem Israel. Now, the historic premillennialists didn't believe that. They believed that the gospel is the fulfillment of all those promises. They believed in a future millennium because they took Revelation 20 literally, but they did not apply some of those Old Testament passages that you would apply to the millennium because they applied them to the church. So, in other words, the belief that there will be a 1,000-year millennium is the only thing they had in common with your belief in the millennium.
Well, no, a future type of tribulation.
I said with your view of the millennium. They had a lot of other views you share. Like I said, they believed in the deity of Christ. So do you. They believe in the virgin birth of Christ. So do you. They believe in the resurrection of Christ. So do you. Those are not distinctives of dispensationalism. Those are distinctives of Christianity.
No.
Dispensationalism has its own distinctives, and it and the historic premillennialists did not share those distinctives.
So you're saying the only thing that makes a dispensationalist is the fact that they believe that those scriptures that were literally interpreted by the church fathers.
Wait, which ones are you talking about?
Were, what's that?
The only scriptures they interpreted literally that you that you interpret literally, and I don't, would be Revelation 20. They would not take Isaiah chapter 2 or Isaiah 11 literally.
Justin Martyr claims that quotes Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and those as that if anybody goes against this belief, talking about those premillennial type of situation, and he did spiritualize the church as being taken the place of Israel, but he literally interpreted that, and he quoted and said would be going against these particular guys written in the Old Testament. So it wasn't just Revelation 20. It was Revelation 20 was interpreted based upon Old Testament scriptures.
But they believe, that the church is Israel.
And that you're saying a dispensationalist, if I'm understanding you correct, is that they only the only difference is they interpret those things as happening to Israel, as the Old Testament scriptures say.
Right, which is the distinctive of dispensationalism. That's what was not believed in the church before 1830.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll go back and I'll take a look at that.
Okay, I appreciate
and,
that.
By
the way, before you go, because we've been talking a long time and I have other calls, but before you go, I just want to say this. You're very interested in the agreement of the church fathers with your position. You and I have also debated Calvinism. Do you know of any church father that held any of the Calvinistic views?
You know, I've only been, right now, no, obviously,
okay.
Other than
Calvin. Well, while you're studying the church fathers, look for the question of whether they hold Calvinist views or Arminian views.
Well, yeah, and I agree. I don't put a lot of stock in it. I just see it as everybody uses it as a basis of why dispensationalism isn't an acceptable thing. And yet, it's like you narrowed it down to one thing. Yet, it appears that people think that dispensationalism is all off in everything, and not everything that are the essential things that they push, such as premillennial, the tribulation, you know.
Okay, you need to understand, Kevin, you need to understand that there are many premillennialists today who would renounce the name dispensational.
Of course.
Yeah, because they're not dispensational, they're premillennial. They're historic premillennialists. And that's a category that is not quite as large as the dispensationalists in our modern times, but is a very large category of theologians are historic premillennial. Now, they would say, and they would say correctly, that the early church fathers agreed with them. But they would say that the church fathers did not agree with dispensationalism because it's not being premillennial is not what is distinctive of dispensationalism. Yes, dispensationalists are premillennial, but so are others who are not dispensationalists. That's why I try to point out the virgin birth. Roman Catholics believe in the virgin birth, and Protestants do. Dispensationalists do, and Reformed people do. The virgin birth is a common belief of many different branches of Christianity, and therefore cannot be a distinctive of one branch. It can be held by that branch, but it's not distinctive of that branch unless they're the only ones who teach it. So when I say what is distinctive of dispensationalism, is their position about Israel.
Well, but also then you would look at Messianics.
Well, they're essentially dispensational gone.
Well, they reject dispensationalism.
Well, I don't know what they say about dispensationalism, but almost all of them started out there.
Being Israel.
I didn't think the Messianics did that. But okay.
Oh, yeah, they do.
See, you know what? The Messianics are not one homogenous group of people who all believe the same thing.
No, they're not. I had one Messianic said they're very messy.
Well,
like
Kevin, we always have a good time.
Some other time.
All right. God bless you, man. All right. Good talking to you again. Bye now. All right, our next caller is Tom from Salinas, and we have lines open for you at 1-800-438-5090. Tom, thanks for waiting. Thanks for calling, too.
Hey, Steve?
Yes.
I have a question on how can you test an apostle?
Okay.
If they're an apostle or not.
Well, a number of things. First of all, I would ask them, what is the basis of their claim? See, sometimes people who say they're apostles, they say, well, I'm an apostle because I do things that apostles do. Well, that's not good enough. I mean, Philip, the evangelist, did things the apostles did, but he wasn't an apostle. He was an evangelist. He did miracles. He preached the gospel. He taught the new Christians. I mean, he did things apostles do, but not as an apostle. He did it as an evangelist. The word apostle means one who is sent. And so an apostle of Jesus Christ has got to be somebody who was sent by Jesus Christ specifically to represent him. If somebody doesn't even claim that they've seen Jesus or that he sent them, then they're not claiming to be an apostle. They're claiming to just want to be an apostle. They're wannabe apostles. See, if somebody says, well, Jesus appeared to me and sent me to go out as an apostle like Paul, well, then I'm interested in hearing more of his story and see how credible he is. I'm going to also take a look at his doctrine, see if he's teaching the same things the apostles taught and Jesus taught. Because if he's teaching different from them, then he's not an apostle of Jesus. Then Paul said there should be signs of an apostle. In 2 Corinthians 12:12, Paul, when he was defending his own apostleship against those who doubted it, he said, surely the signs of an apostle were wrought among you in all signs and wonders and mighty deeds. In other words, he's saying that the miracles he did were the signs that he was an apostle. So a person who's a real apostle must have been sent by Jesus, must have or should have signs and wonders to confirm that they really do have a supernatural, commission. And their doctrine should be the same as that of Jesus and the apostles. Those are the ways I'd test them. Now, if somebody has a credible claim that Jesus appeared to them and sent them, and they have the signs and wonders to prove it, and they have the spirit and the doctrine of the apostles and of Christ, I'm going to be interested. That's why I say Sundar Singh would have made a good apostle. He had all that going for him, but I don't remember him ever claiming to be an apostle.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's somebody I've heard that the leaders claim him to be an apostle, but at the same time, he does talk about, like, he does kind of emphasize, like, the others, like the rest of the leaders, you know, about the ties and stuff like that. And I'm like,
he's just...
I've heard him speak different about the ties, but I've heard him speak, like, you know, about that. I mean, the rest of it that he says is pretty right on, except for that part is funny to me.
Well, I would want to know how I'd like to know how and when he was sent by Jesus out as an apostle. If he has a good answer, then I'd like to hear more. But I think an awful lot of people who claim to be apostles, they're not even including that as part of their claim. They're just saying, hey, I'm authoritative. You see, the word apostle carried a lot of authority in the early church and would today if we have real ones too. So there's a lot of people who'd like to be apostles because that means people have to listen to them. People have to believe what they say. That's sure a more privileged position than the average pastor who you can take or leave what he says. But I don't really know of any apostles that claim to be apostles that can point out that they were sent in that sense. Anyway, Tom, I'm afraid we're out of time. I appreciate your call very much and those others who called as well. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we do this daily because we buy the radio time on several radio stations to do so. We are listener-supported. The money to pay the stations comes from listeners like you. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. By the way, I'm going to be speaking in Las Vegas this weekend. Hope those of you who are there will want to check that out at our website, thenarrowpath.com, at the link announcements. Have a great afternoon, and we hope to talk to you again tomorrow. God bless. Thank you.